Pattern Podcast. Make left traffic, clear for the option.
Minneapolis departure, Archer 641, Charlie 2000, climbing 3000.
Line up and wait, 7 range, 4 Mike Alpha.
Mark Tower, 172, Romeo Hotel, holding short on the 133, ready to take off.
Albert Delta, about to make it 2-1 Mike, entering the downwind for runway 25.
I'm John.
I'm Chris.
I'm Brad.
And I'm Mark.
And we are the In the Pattern Podcast.
Welcome to episode 32 of the In the Pattern Podcast. Thanks for coming along and joining us in the virtual hangar this morning, this evening, or this afternoon, whatever it may be, where you're at right now. This is Chris, and along with me, as usual, is John, Brad, and Mark. How you guys doing tonight?
Hey, how's it going? Pretty good.
Good, good. Brad?
No complaints.
Excellent. Mr. Mark, how's it out there in SoCal?
Or it's I should say cold.
NorCal,
yeah, right. But it's cold. I want to go back to Hawaii.
Define cold, please.
You've already been...
Warmer than you. What'd you say?
I said you've already been to Hawaii like twice since I've known you, and I haven't been once yet.
Wow. That's because you fly more than me.
Yeah. That's where I tend to put my spare change. Yeah. Everybody been doing good? Sounds like. Working lots and trying to stay warm now that we're in the winter months. We're recording this episode, and I'm going to let you know, even though who knows when it's going to get out. December 13th it is today, only
2013.
11 more shopping days till the Christmas. Yes. And John, Brad, you guys got snow on the ground?
We had a little bit. It very quickly has kind of melted away. We were supposed to get up to 6 inches. I actually didn't even go to work on Tuesday, because we were supposed to get this huge amount of snow, and halfway through the storm, they were like, oh, we're going to cancel all the warnings. We're only going to get like 1 to 3, and then it just melted by the end of the day.
Your boss call you at lunchtime? Come on in?
No. Actually, I mean, I could have gone in. You know, I mean, I get paid hourly, so it's just when I work. But I had already put in and being late or not at all, and by the point that I realized I could have actually gone in, I was too busy knee-deep in editing and doing some other stuff, so I was actually getting a lot of own personal work done, so it was actually a very good day.
And, yeah, good for
listeners.
You
should enjoy that, because I spent it editing videos and trying to edit audio, though yet again we've had audio issues, but rant for later.
Par for the course for the In the Pattern Podcast.
Skype, but plain Skype.
Yeah. Brad, you built your first snowman yet?
Yeah, we've got, I don't know, it's been pretty easy. We've got probably 6 or 8 inches on the ground right now, and it's been slowly sublimating away. A little chilly for early December, a lot of below 0 days, and that means it's pretty tough to fly.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's winter, it's Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
It's all good.
Mm-hmm.
How about you?
Well, you know, that cold snap that went through last week, that, you know, it was bad for a lot of people and whatnot, I guess. You know, for us, I mean, we had freezing temperatures. So we were at the 32s, you know, which is, this is kind of early for us to even hit that. We do get below freezing temperatures, but not usually until January or late in December. So it's a little early for us, but we did hit it. We're out of it. I didn't even have a jacket to go to work today, so it was, 50s and 60s again. So
yeah.
It was like 18 here. I mean, people were out in shorts and barbecuing, and it's nice. Amazing how warm 18 above feels when you've been in 18 below for a long time.
No kidding. Yeah. Oh, well, enough of the weathers, I suppose. Let's move on to talking about this aviation thing we love so much. And let's talk a little bit about flying. And I know, Brad, you've been doing a lot of flying, all kinds of different kinds of flying. You've been flying puppies around and people. Tell us about what's going on up there with your flying.
Yeah, I finally finished off my high-performance endorsement, and so I can fly our club's Cherokee 6. I'm very happy about that, although my wallet is not.
It's a thirsty beach.
Yeah, 23 gallons to 24 gallons an hour on climb out, and then you can lean it back to about 16 in flight. And that
economy cruise.
Yeah, it gets spendy in a hurry. But you can have a whole bunch of people in there, and if you divide that up six ways, it turns out okay. Beyond that, I did my first pilot and pause flight. And Pilots and Paws is an organization that helps to relocate rescue dogs, dogs that need to find a home or they're not going to be long for this earth in the home that they're at. And they oftentimes are composed of people who are driving an animal or a bunch of animals from one location to another, and then they need a pilot to help them make the some stretch of that trip in order to get them to safety. And so I took Chris Gustafson, aka Aviation Junkie for you Twitter folks, and a dog and I, and we made a flight from the Twin Cities area and picked up a dog in South St. Paul and relocated him to Wausau, Wisconsin, which is not terribly far from Oshkosh in the grand scheme of things. Very nice dog, actually. It was a great experience on the whole. The challenging bits were figuring out how to get the dog into this low-winged airplane because he's a new dog to us. We didn't have any idea what he was like or if he would bite on us at all. And he had just had surgery to be fixed, mm-hmm. as it were, and so we didn't really want to pick him up and send him up on the wing. But Chris grabbed him by the harness. I made sure that he had a harness that we could use to secure him in the back seat of the Archer that we used to transport him. And so he picked him up by the harness, set him on the wing. I got the dog into the plane, seatbelted the harness into one of the seats, and it had a great experience from start to finish. The dog was wonderful. He just laid down and settled in and relaxed. It was a very hazy day for flying, but it was still VFR. We had probably 6 or so miles of visibility, but very easy flight. Did flight following the bulk of the way out there until we were out of radar contact, and put in, and the person who was going to take him to the dog's new home was right there waiting for us at the airport, dropped him off, and had a really, really easy return flight. And I was just amazed at how easy it was to do. For me, it was just a nice way to get out and go flying and log some time, and managed to do a little good in the process.
Excellent.
So had a great time. Got to go flying with Chris and show him some different kinds of flying. Flying in relatively low visibility is in VFR is. I was telling him that if I hadn't been instrument rated, it would have been a lot more nerve wracking. But because I knew the area and was instrument rated, it was a very easy flight. Even though we flew at VFR.
Cool. Now, if I'm correct, Chris is a student pilot right now.
Chris is a student pilot. He is kind of a perpetual student pilot. He's been working on his private pilot's license for a lot longer than any of us. And I've been trying
you
to
sure
get...
about that?
Yes.
he does have you on that one, Mark.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I think we talked with Chris at the Oshkosh about that, a.k.a. also known as Donkey.
Yeah, also known as Donkey. And I'm not going to go there.
Yeah.
But he's been a student pilot for a long time and is looking to finish things off. And I've been trying to get Chris to join my flying club just because he's local to me and it's a great club. And we're just trying to get him squared away with somebody who's looking to sell a share.
Nice.
Cool.
So what is it? Let me ask you about the Pilots and Paws. Thank you. My flight instructor, Jackie, who I did my primary with, is a part of that. And I know several times during my training, she would go, run these dogs from one place to another and so forth. What is the requirements?
That's a great question. I think you just need to be a pilot. Their requirements are basically a VFR pilot who is current, and I think that's it.
Not like 100 minimum of pilot in command or anything like that?
Well, let me look it up. Okay. Whatever it was, I had it, but...
Because Flights for Life is like that for, the blood runs that I run with my buddy Dean in the Cessna 140. That's their requirements, 100 hours PIC.
Yeah, and I know some of the other ones, like when you're actually transporting patients, like the angel flight and stuff is more, and you have to have certain ratings or whatever.
I think you have to be IFR rated for that.
Yeah.
I'm trying to get into angel flight, and angel flight up here in the upper Midwest, you have to have an instrument rating, you have to be current and proficient on instruments, and you have to have either 500 hours or 250 hours and a commercial.
Wow.
And so I'm looking forward to finishing off my commercial rating so that I can do some angel flights. But for now, Pilots and Paws is a nice way to do something that kind of gives back and makes it, just... You get kind of the good feeling of helping someone or some animal, and you get to go flying. So mm-hmm. it all works out.
Yeah, nice deal.
Yeah, that's cool. So how did you get involved with them?
I found out about them I think via social media, and they have a website, Pilots and Paws, Pilots the letter N, paws.org. And they have all of the information that you need to know on there. You can sign up. You tell them where you're located. And then if they have an animal or animals that need to be relocated that are going to go past where you are, you'll get an email. And you can go online and communicate with the person who's doing the relocation and kind of work things out. If you're able to help out and you can make the schedules all work out, then great. You can help to relocate some of these animals. And it's very low key, very low pressure. Nobody's going to try to push you into doing anything. And if it's not a safe time to make the flight because of weather or any other reason, everybody is very understanding of kind of where things are. And it's just about trying to help out and be safe.
Yeah, that's really cool. I saw them, and I'm trying to remember where. I think obviously I've seen them in Oshkosh, but I think I was talking to some of the people who were doing it. At I think it was a guy in a Cherokee at the Become a Pilot Day, and he had the whole setup along his wings and stuff like that, and I always thought that'd be really cool to do, and then I saw that you had done the flight, and I was like, yeah, it's actually really cool. I was kind of looking forward to talking to you about it, because it was one of those things that I had seen and heard about and thought was cool, but I wasn't quite sure how to get involved. So
Yeah.
We'll put that link in the show notes, too. So
yeah, please do. And it's, like I said, there's really no minimum hours like what you would have for doing an angel flight or something like that, where you're carrying people around. Logistically, it's pretty straightforward. The website talks about kind of really what you should expect, which is you're going to want a crate for the animal or a harness to be able to harness them in and strap them in, so that if you're encountering turbulence or anything like that, the dog is not becoming a safety hazard or at risk of getting injured flying around in the unprotected inside of the cockpit. The dog that I was dealing with was really nice and easy. He wasn't sick at all. The weather was great. It was extremely stable air. He just laid down in the seat and kind of was like, yep, I'm, good night. Wake me when we get to the other end. And he was happy as could be when we got to where we were going. Nice. So you know, very positive experience. I was glad that that was the animal that we had for my first flight and doing this relocation. If it had been a dog that was, you know, aggressive or really sick or something like that, it might have been a little less pleasant. But it was just a dream flight. It really was easy.
So the noise didn't bother him or anything. That was good.
Yeah, the noise wasn't a problem. I didn't have any kind of, you know, they make mutt muffs and things like that to put over dogs' ears. Right. I just kept him in the back and, like I said, seatbelted his harness to just ran a seatbelt through the harness, and he was fine with that. I put some towels down on the seat just in case he had any issues, and he didn't. So everything worked out just fine.
Fantastic.
This is really cool. I'm looking at their website right now, and so it looks like they do dogs, cats, and reptiles.
Yep.
There's an article here about an injured turtle flown from Sarnia for treatment in Petersburg.
Yeah, and if you sign in and get into the website, when they send you a relocation request, there'll be a link on there to SkyVector, which will show you, here's the route, if you were to fly it end-to-end, that the animal would need to go on. It's not sophisticated enough to say, well, here's the segment of the route that we're looking for. At least I haven't seen that yet. But if they need, you know, in my case, South St. Paul to Wausau, Wisconsin, you click on the thing and it brings up SkyVector, and you can see exactly where you're going to be doing the flight if you choose to take it.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Well, if there's no hourly requirement, then I'm definitely going to check it out soon.
Yeah,
me too.
There's no hourly requirement. This is Part 91 flying. Oftentimes it is a 501c3, so you can consider the expense of the flight to be a charitable donation
and
get some tax benefits from that.
Dean does that with the blood flights too, like right. You know, so he keeps track of how much, you know, fuel it cost, and then, you know, since there's no cost, there's no payment on the plane or anything like that, you know, general maintenance.
Right. Yeah, this is totally on the pilot to do it. You are assuming all of the expense. So the best thing that you can hope for out of all of this is some kind of a tax break, which isn't always there. But for the flights that it is, at least you get some amount of discount. And even if you don't, you're still going flying.
Nothing wrong with that.
That's right. If the worst thing comes out of it is that, well, you got to go flying, so be it.
Right.
Oh, nice.
So Brad, you mentioned something there, and I gotta bring it up and ask, how's that commercial doing?
It's slowed down a little bit, partially because of the weather. It's the wintertime, and we've had a really, really cold December. We usually are not so far below zero this time of year, but right now we are. And when it's this cold, our planes basically don't leave the hangar very much. And work has picked up a lot for me, so I've been less able to get out and work on maneuvers. But it's still coming. I would expect that before springtime rolls around, I'll probably have the commercial knocked out, and then we can talk a little bit more about doing things like angel flights and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So
nice.
The commercial requirement for hours is 250. Is that right?
250 hours. You need to have. There are some cross-country requirements, some of which you need to do with an instructor that exceed the private pilot cross-countries.
Mm-hmm.
Some of which you need to do solo, and I can't remember all of them off the top of my head. The flight that I did to visit my folks who are down in Arkansas was enough for me to count for my solo long cross country requirements for that. And I have more than 250 hours now, so I'm set on that front, but I still need to take an instructor up and do a long, I believe it's just the long night cross country at this point.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know how a lot of people talk about, and I was thinking this was, a genius way to do it, but to do your commercial and your instrument at the same time, knock them both out. But then once you add in 250 total hours, I'm like, well, dang. You know, if it only took you 50, 55 hours to get your private and another 50 hours to get your instrument, I don't think so, you know? I'm just going to have to build some up on my own, you know? It's a little bit too big of a gap.
If it's one of those things where if you happen to be going for your instrument around the time that you're approaching 250 hours,
exactly,
then it works out okay. And if it's not, then it's not.
Mm-hmm.
It also, the long dual cross countries that you have to do must be flown VFR. You cannot be flying even on an instrument flight plan in VMC. So it's a little bit different.
Like, I've just broke 112 hours. So I think maybe once I've hit 150-ish hours, if I wanted to knock out both of those at the same time, might be a good time to start them. Maybe a little later than that. I don't know.
And the commercial is just a lot. The single engine commercial is just a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. Chandelles and lazy eights and 60-degree banks and...
Yeah, it's just all performance stuff.
Yeah.
It's pushing the envelope of VFR flying out a little bit farther. And the reason that they have the rating in the first place is so that you can go do crazy things like crop dusting and banner towing and pipeline patrol and all of that stuff where you're flying the airplane a little bit closer to the edges of the envelope than you would doing normal private pilot stuff. Now, I'm not really looking to do any of that stuff and get paid for it. For me, the commercial is more of a gateway to do things like Angel Flight, where I can do it with 250 hours instead of 500. It's just learning better control of the airplane, better stick and rudder skills, better precision flying. And it really is a lot of fun. They're not difficult maneuvers once you get the hang of them. And I'm doing it all in the Mooney, race car of an airplane.
Nice. Good choice.
You're also avoiding that BFR next.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. If I can get it done before the end of April, I'll miss another 2 years of BFR. It'll be 2016 before I ever need to do a BFR. And then if I get the seaplane rating, that'll push that a little further. So
the multi-engine and the...
And the multi, yeah, that's another easy one to pick off.
I think once I got my commercial, I want to go try. I want someone to hire me to drop skydivers. I want to, what else? Banner tow, that would be fun. Tow gliders.
I saw you had that tweet where that was on your bucket list.
Yeah, all that stuff.
The skydiving one was really interesting until that incident up in Superior a few
years ago.
Look, you know what? Let's not hash that, but seriously, there was some just dumb formation flight going on there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He wasn't paying attention to his airspeed. He actually did stall.
Stalled on top of the other plane.
But either way, the fact that they were not in visual range of each other, neither one could see the other plane, just that. Yeah.
Yeah. Bad plan.
I still want to go skydiving, though. I don't care.
Yeah.
I'll do it.
I've done it once, jumping out of the plane. That was enough.
I'm happy to fly you up there. I'm not jumping out.
I want to do all that stuff at least once.
Yeah, I want to jump out. But... Cool. So, with that, Chris.
Moving along.
Chris.
Yes, yes.
Now I hear you've got over 100 hours. You're at like 112, something like that. I swear, just all you do is fly.
No. it's nice. I go about once a month. Once in a while, I get up twice. And the beauty of it is now is that a buddy of mine named Franz, I work with his wife, and me and him both seem to get our pilot's license at about the same time. We both rent the same plane. We've became really good friends. And like, for example, last night I'm up at work, 4:45, I get a text. Hey, you want to go flying? Let me check to see what the spousal unit has on tap for tonight. I think she's working. So I text my wife. Hey, are you working tonight? Yeah, I'm working. Okay, I'm going flying, you know. So it's a beauty because me and him go fly a lot together. And you know, to rent a plane for $50 an hour because we split the cost, you know, how are you going to beat that? So luckily I've been able to get up a little more often, especially because we're splitting the cost quite a few times.
Yeah, that's a sweet deal there.
Yeah. So I'm happy about that.
My buddy who flies, he's actually not current right now. He hasn't flown in about 6 months, but he's trying to go up. Of course, he's trying to go up tomorrow, and it's going to snow, so we'll see how that goes. But quite have the same deal of being able to split the cost, so that's neat.
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely nice, and, you know, my side work's been staying fairly steady, so I've always got a little cash on hand to go do it. So speaking of that, I've had some fairly fun flights since the last podcast. In fact, this first one I'm going to talk about, I was with Franz. Franz deals in exotic cars, and specifically he's Arizona's Ariel Atom dealer. And if you're familiar with the Ariel Atom, it's like an open wheel, street legal ready race car. You know, it's almost like a Formula One car.
It's a 250-mile-an-hour go-kart.
Yeah, not quite that fast, but it's a beast. And,
it's close.
Yeah, it's a fast little car with a Honda engine in the back of it. But it only weighs 1,300 pounds, so it's incredible. Matter of fact, we took one of them to lunch one day, and we were going around. You guys know what a roundabout is, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so we were going around a roundabout at over 50 miles an hour, and it's just grip, 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 and G-forces trying to, like, suck your face off the side of the car. It's a cool car. Anyway, so Franz deals in exotic cars, and he has a friend down south towards Tucson. East of Tucson a little bit. And it's called Indy Motorsports, and it's a racetrack, a road course, and people go down there and they race their motorcycles or their cars or whatever whenever race events are held. And the cool thing is that the owner of the place, the original owner, I shouldn't say original owner because he still owns it, but we were talking to the son. But anyways, the father is a pilot. And so the straightaway is designated as a runway. So we talked to him and got permission to come down there and land. And they were going to talk some business while we were there to make it all worthwhile. So we flew down to Indy Motorsports Ranch and had a good time. There's all kinds of military jet aircraft on static display on the property too, which was really cool. I don't know where he got it all, but he has like a F-102 Starfighter. And F-4 Phantom, several MiGs. I can't remember all, but I was like, whoa, where did he get all this stuff? So his dad's got some connections.
Nice. So you landed on the straightaway?
Yeah, so we landed on the straightaway, and it was, let me tell you, it was windy. We left Glendale, and luckily, well, at Glendale, we had a fairly stiff crosswind at between 10 and 15 knots. Not horrible, but just comfortable enough. Much more than that, and we weren't going to go. So anyways, we got down there, and, you know, we get on the radio, and we're talking to the guy who we're going to meet. He's up on an observation tower, and he's got a handheld radio, and he's talking to us and telling us what the winds are like, yada, yada, yada. And they were, I forget, I tweeted about it, but they were gusting to 20-something, maybe 23, 25, something like that. But luckily, it was almost directly down the runway, so that was pretty good. So Franz had the leg there, and I was going to take the leg home. So Franz did the landing, and, you know, it wasn't pretty, but it was safe, and we got on the ground and tied down the airplane and then walked into one of the garages and talked. And inside this garage while we were there, there was two McLarens. Not the McLaren F1s, but the newer model. I forget what it's called.
MC12.
That sounds about right. It was one was black, one was white. It was a husband and wife's car. They raced together, I guess. There was a Ferrari 430 Scuderia.
Wow.
a couple Porsches and all kinds of BMW M3s. There was a couple of those Ariel Adams there. And they were talking about just trying to get some sort of Ariel Adams specific race to go on down there. So anyways, it was a blast. And if I told Franz, I said, hey, sometime on the weekend, whenever they're going to have a race, we got to fly down here ahead of time and then watch the race from, they have what looks like an ATC control tower for an observation area. And
so that's observation, not a control tower. I was just looking at the pictures and saw that.
Oh, did you see it? Yeah. Isn't that cool?
So it's observation only, not a control tower?
Well, I don't know. I don't know what's inside there. It's not a control tower for obvious, air traffic control, but it probably is for the race officials or something.
Okay.
You know, because you got a great view of the whole track from there. So I did the takeoff. Again, luckily the wind was still howling, but pretty much straight down the runway. So after about 9 feet, we were off the ground in the 172 and headed back to Phoenix and flew back to Phoenix right during sunset. The sun was just setting as we were taking off and had some just a beautiful red sky as we were flying all the way back to Phoenix and had a nice flight back. So that was a nice flight, altogether 3.3 hours between the leg down and leg back. So that was one of the longer flights I've taken. And then about three weeks ago, I took a friend of mine from work and his girlfriend with me. I wanted to go up north to go hit up the big hole in the ground, the crater from a meteor that happened millions and millions of years ago. So there's a meteor crater up north, just east of Flagstaff and just a little bit west of Winslow, Arizona. And so we flew up there and we got within about 20 miles or less, maybe 15 miles of where the crater should be. And it was completely socked in with clouds. Couldn't get underneath of them without crashing into the ground for sure. And before I left, I was looking at the radar and everything, and I didn't see any clouds specifically that low at all. So it might have been there and I missed it. But I looked at like 3 or 4 different places for weather online, and I missed it. So if I knew that, I wouldn't have gone, because that's a fairly long flight up there. So speaking of clouds, though, we actually flew through a little cloud. I know I'm supposed to stay away from clouds, but it would just happen to be in our way. It was scattered. I could see almost all the way through it, and it was just happened to be in our path. And real funny, as soon as I hit that cloud, turbulence, boom, 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 just kind of bounced around, and then boom, you're out of it. So that was kind of weird. First time being in a cloud in a small plane. We don't have many of those up here. Clouds, that is. So we had
bad monkey.
I know. Don't tell the FAA on me. Then there was another layer of clouds ahead of us, and we I went down underneath them, and then once we saw those other clouds, it was just like, well, crap. I mean, the clouds happened to be at like a layer that was at the edge of a canyon. It was almost like almost looked like the ground that I could see below me, then ahead of me just turned into a cloud layer, as if the clouds were sitting on the ground, but it was because there was a canyon that went down, and then that happened to be the tops of the clouds, if you can get what I'm trying to paint you a picture of.
Interesting.
So I got to get back up there to try it again. I've been talking about getting up there to see this meteor crater for a long time, and I just keep missing opportunities, and then once I got to actually go see it, I couldn't make it to it. So we diverted over to Payson. Just did a quick touch and go there and then back to Glendale. So that was 2.3 hours.
Yeah, Meteor Crater is one of those places I really want to go to. I mean, I've been hearing about that and reading about it since I was little.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, I mean, just I've always been into the space stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So it was always like one of those places that just looked really cool, but just I haven't gotten a chance to get out there yet.
Yeah, it looks pretty cool. I can't wait to get up there and get some pictures of it. That's really what I want to do. I'll be a passenger on a flight. I don't even care about flying there. I want to really get some pictures from the air from it.
Yeah.
It looks pretty cool. I mean, it's so big, you could fly the 172, you could do laps around the inside edge of that rim all day long. I don't think they'd like that none too much, though.
Probably not.
put black tape or something over the FAA numbers of the plane. Do it.
That's also very illegal.
Okay, don't do that either. Anyways, and other than that, like I mentioned, Franz, you know, texted me and asked me to go flying last night. So we did a quick night flight, and he had nowhere specific he wanted to go. And he said, you know, do you have any plan? Do you have any ideas where to go? I said, hey, let's do the lap. And he's like, what are you talking about? I said, we'll leave Glendale. We'll transition the Phoenix Bravo, then land at Chandler. Or not land. We'll do a touch and go at Chandler, touch and go at Williams Gateway Airport, then Falcon Field, then Scottsdale, then Deer Valley, and then back to Glendale. He's like, "Whoa, I've never did that before." That's one of my favorite flights. You gotta be on top of your game on the radio for that one right there. Hmm. And if you check out our sectional or the TAC, like for example. Williams Gateway and Falcon Field, their airspaces are, I think there's less than a mile separation between where one stops and one starts. So, you know, you let them know as you're coming in, hey, after I take back off, my intentions are Falcon Field. And basically, as soon as your wheels are off the ground and you've got about, you know, 500 feet underneath you, they release you inside their airspace to go talk to the next tower right ahead. Otherwise, you'll never make it unless you definitely divert. So it's a lot of fun. We you know, talk about crew resource management. We were working together really well. He was when he was doing the flying, I was doing a lot of his radio work for him, especially changing the radios. Oh, and that just reminds me, going back to the beginning of this flight and pre-flighting and everything, we get in the plane, get ready to start it up, go through the checklist, and as soon as he hits the master, we hear a pop and the radio comes on. Someone had left the avionics master on, and it screwed up COM 1.
Really?
Yeah. So it's your standard Bendix King KX whatever digital radios that you see in a lot of planes, you know,
the 94 or whatever.
Yeah. So is it a LCD screen?
Probably LCD.
Yeah. So it looks like it had like burned out after that. Like, you could kind of see the letters, or the numbers, I mean, but not really well.
Oh, the backlight went out.
Yeah. Oh, because...
the backlight went out.
But if you put your flashlight on it, you could see the numbers really well.
So, yeah, the screens, they're basically... you've got the LCD, you know, the liquid crystal display, mm-hmm. is what actually makes the colors. Mm-hmm. But behind it, or on the edges or whatever, they actually light the screen. So yeah. There's actually a light behind it that goes out that actually makes it so you can see it. So it just blew the backlight out of it.
If that was only the worst part of it. So then I was like, wow, that's kind of weird. And I was like, well, COM 2 still's lit up nicely, and I can see if I turn the knob, I can still see the numbers turning, especially if I have the flashlight on COM 1, and COM 2 looks completely normal. So anyways, call up ground, you know, Glendale ground, Skyhawk 97811, rated taxi, yada, yada, yada. Skyhawk 811, barely audible. There sounds like you're in a tunnel. There's all kinds of background noise. Try again. I'm like, ah, crap. So we tried again. He said it did sound bad. We told him we'd switch over to COM 2. We switched to I'm sorry. I take that back. Because of the way it looked, we assumed COM 1 had the bad problem. So we talked to him first on COM 2, which is the one that looked okay. And he said that was the one that sounded bad. So COM 2 was affected too, as far as the transmit go. The receive was fine, but the transmit to him was really bad, and we could still get ATIS on it and everything just fine. We switched to COM 1 and talked to him, and he said it sounded a lot better, definitely usable, and he cleared us to taxi, yada, yada, yada. So I feel bad for Al, the owner of the plane. We gave him a squawk report in an email later and let him know what happened. But the guy who, you know, took the plane before us obviously didn't turn the avionics master off. And unfortunately, it's not on the sheet to check to see if the avionics master is off first before you turn on the regular master. So
that's interesting, because I think my checklist does have that.
It does?
Interesting. Yeah, I think
mine does.
It does?
Yeah, it's to verify. Too.
Huh.
Yeah.
Well, I'll have to look at ours. I don't ever remember seeing it, and it just may be a variation. And this is just a standard 172P.
If not, it's going to be there now, right?
Yeah. It would definitely be something to put there now, because this is going to be an expensive repair bill. So,
yeah,
to overhaul those, and possibly downtime. You know, I mean, we made it work only because we just used COM2 to hear ATIS along the way, and then we were just flipping back and forth between COM1, and I don't even know what it looks like in the day. You know,
you're
like
not
I said,
read any of it.
Like I said, we put the flashlight on it to see the numbers in it. It looked perfect, but you take it away and it looked like crap. And then during the day, which is the ambient lighting, I don't know. It just may be junk. So anyways, it's definitely going to need to get some work, and I feel bad for Al now. So
yeah.
Anyway, so we did that lap, got in. So he took off from Glendale and did the touch and go, or did the Bravo transition, the touch and go at Chandler. Touch and go at Williams Gateway, and touch and go at, or no, the, a full stop landing at Falcon. We swapped seats, and I took off from Falcon and did Scottsdale and Deer Valley, and then landed back at Glendale and put it away. So that was a lot of fun. 1.8 hours on the Hobbs on that one there. That's one of my favorite little in-town flights that you never leave town, but you stay busy.
Yeah, I did one of those around Baltimore. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. I would love to do the Hudson River transition someday.
That would be my list.
The Hudson Corridor.
It's not that far. I mean, I think I'm like 2 hours.
Oh, dude, you got to do that. You got to grab two friends and go do that and split that flight.
I'm going to need some skinny friends.
Dude.
Or a bigger airplane.
Come on. 172 with three people's fine all day long, with full tanks, in cold weather at least. You can do that.
Yeah, you weigh what, like 140 pounds?
174, thank you.
Whatever.
Hey, dude, I need to be 150 is what I need to be.
Yeah, I need to be 180. See how that goes.
All right. Our New Year's resolutions.
Hey, I've been trying. Well, actually, you know, living with the mother-in-law for a while and not having a kitchen that I could use hurt. So now that we've been in our own place, it's getting a little better. We're getting there.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I need to go do some running or something, because one day I'll fit four people in a 172. I'll do it.
Yeah, if you're that close to that, you got to go see that. I'd love to see that. I've seen so many videos of it. I'd love to do it in person.
Yeah, that would be pretty cool.
Looks like fun. So tell us about your flying, John.
Well, before I do that, I'm going to take a real quick second to tell you something I really have been liking recently. And that is the Stock MacGyvecast Practical Guide to Winter Flying. This is an online video course. It'll teach you the ins and outs of flying in the winter and dealing with and around the ice. The course is actually taught by two very experienced pilot flight instructors and airline pilots, and they're actually good friends of ours over at the Stuck My Cavcast, Lynn Costa and Carl Flary. And they've jam-packed a 60-minute course with everything you need to know and think about when you're preparing to fly in this cold winter months. So if you're like me and Brad and you're flying in the winter, forget about that Chris guy down there in the warmth, you know.
Hey, I just got to go north for about 15, 20 minutes.
Yeah.
I'll be okay.
Or if you're flying in Alaska in the summer, you know, this is a great course to take. They go over a lot of stuff like how to taxi in slush, how to deal with the snowbanks, different types of snow, different types of ice, and how to avoid them. And they have a whole section devoted to every pilot's favorite topic ever, emergency procedures.
Yes.
And these guys also know you like to listen to podcasts. Like a lot of us, you like to listen to them while driving. So they also have included a really handy MP3 audio supplement that you can download while you're learning, so you can learn on your commute to work. You can also stream the course to any of your devices. They have a mobile-friendly site, which also means that you can stream it through your Apple TV, which I was actually doing earlier today, and it's fantastic. You can also download the transcripts, grab a PDF that includes the slides and the instructor notes, and they have a ton of information in the course. And the best part about the whole thing is that you can get it for the same price as 1 hour of flight instruction. So if you'd like, and this sounds really interesting to you, you can go check them out over winterflying.inthepatternpodcast.com. That'll take you to their site. We can find out more about the course. And if you do decide to purchase the course, it's going to go ahead and help us out with the hosting costs and let us be able to bring this show to you guys. So we'd really appreciate it. And a real special thanks to the Stuff Mike Avcast.
What was that website again?
And that is winterflying.inthepatternpodcast.com. And that'll be in the show notes for you.
Cool.
Yeah. So, I actually just started going through that course too, and there's it's some neat stuff in there. I'm enjoying it, especially since it's winter, and because it's winter, I've not been flying as much as I would have liked to. I actually haven't been up since October. Last time I went up was late October, actually the Sunday after we did our last recording for episode 31. I've been trying to get up. I really tried to get up in November, and it just didn't work out. And the problem I have now is I'm looking at every weekend, and it's going to snow. So it's like, crap. So speaking of ice and snow, yeah, it's not a good idea to go flying in the snow when it's coming down out of the sky. So I've been kind of trying to keep up on the weather and decide when is a good chance to go ahead and fly. But so far, I haven't been able to find a good weekend that's clear, so I might just resort to taking some time off work and go during the week and get up, because I need to go up at least one more time before the end of the year just to fulfill my goal of getting to 80 hours by the end of the year. So I'm gonna do it,
play hooky,
do it before Christmas. But the one flight I did do since the last episode though was I had a really cool day taking up three people for their first flights. And rented the plane.
That's my favorite.
Taking out people. It's just fantastic. And so I took my brother up, and we took off on Martin State, went down to Cambridge. My grandparents have a place in Cambridge. Now, this flight, seriously, I've been trying to do this flight since I got my private. And we've been trying to schedule, and it just never worked. So finally, I was like, heck with it. I'm just going to get an airplane, and everybody's free, they're free. And whoever's free can just go with me. And it just turned out that this weekend, the first time I tried to just say, screw it, I'll just do it, everybody was free, and it just worked out. So took my brother, took him up. We flew down to Cambridge, kind of flew all along the bay, and then flew over my grandparents' house. They're on the eastern shore of Maryland, just off the bay. I think it's like a little chop tank or something like that. They have a little property down there. So we flew over there properly and flew into Cambridge. So then we landed, met up with my grandparents, and then I took each of them up individually for their first flight. So I took my grandfather up first, and I took my grandmother second. So I actually did a whole bunch of takeoff and landings from Cambridge. But each flight, I got them in the plane, got them all situated, did a quick, not necessarily a full pre-flight, but just made sure that nobody hit the plane while we were sitting there and there was oil in it and all that kind of stuff. And, just, general walk around and some other stuff, fired up the airplane, went down, did a quick check and took off, then, exited the pattern, went to the west, overflew their house, and then flew over a little mansion that is down on the corner, which is, it's actually, kind of a really big property that they built up, and they had always seen it from their boat, so it was kind of neat to take them over it for the first time, in an airplane, and kind of see it from the air. And then we headed back to Cambridge, entered the pattern, and landed. Did the same thing with my grandmother, took her out, took her over her house and the other house, and came back. And it was I don't know, maybe 15 minutes of flight, actually in the air, plus ground time. But, so over an hour, I took them both up, and it was really cool for them because it was their first flights, and they were just amazing. Even my grandmother, she was a little worried getting in, but she wasn't nearly as bad as my mom had been. But she, as soon as we got up, she was like, wow, she was like, this is amazing. And the funny thing is, we were coming in after we landed. She said something. She was like, man, I was expecting, like, when you were going to go to land, it was going to be like dive bombing the runway, like just pointing the nose down and down we go.
That's not how you do it?
Yeah.
Well, how do you do it?
Wait a minute. So, that's what the flaps are for, right?
So her comment was, she was like, I didn't even notice that we were coming down, because it's just, I guess she was expecting a lot more pitch in it, and it was just, well, kind of flat.
At least if she flew with me, she would get what she's expecting.
Maybe a little bounce at the end?
Oh, no, baby. Four. All butter. Just roll them tires on.
But she had a blast. My grandfather had a blast. It was neat. So everybody enjoyed it. Everyone had a good time. Afterwards, we had lunch at the little cafe there, and that was a good flight for them too. It was also a really good learning experience for me because this is the first time I had done that many flights in a row, where I was stopping the airplane, starting the airplane, all that kind of stuff. So I was getting a lot of takeoffs, touchdowns, pulling in, parking, dealing with, you know, the random stuff at a busy cafe on a Sunday. I mean, we went down on a Sunday and literally, I mean, it was packed there. There was a Kodiak on floats that came in. There was a Mooney. There was a Cirrus. There was a couple other planes. I mean, it was just, there's people in and out, coming in for food, coming up. There was one guy who the entire time we were there flying was doing pattern work. So there's at least 2 to 3 people in the pattern every time that we were trying to get back into it. And one of my weak points throughout all of my training and afterwards, I have always felt is entering the pattern. And I don't know what it was about it. It wasn't, I was nervous to do it. It just never felt right. And I don't quite know what it was, but it was really good getting 3 chances to leave and then re-enter the pattern and really try to figure out, okay, how do I enter? How do I get in? How do I make sure that where all the other planes are? And I don't know, for some reason this time it clicked. It went really well. I feel a lot more comfortable about, you know, getting in and out of the pattern in an uncontrolled airport without, you know, ramming into anybody or anything like that. So
you turned a nice, you know, sightseeing flight into a training flight and, you know, benefited greatly.
Yeah.
Love that.
It's great because, you know, my passenger's having a great time because they're first flight and they're just mesmerized by everything that's going on. And here I am. I'm like learning a whole bunch of stuff and
a lot
of good landings in. So
should have put Granny on the radio and had her do the calls.
Yeah, I don't think that would work. So actually, it was funny because they were like, there's no control tower. Well, how do you? And I was like, well, here, let me show you.
John, said, John, who are you talking to? No one's talking back. You realize that.
Yeah, she was actually saying that like through the whole beginning of the flight. I'm trying to explain to her. She's like, who are you talking to? And how do you know where other people are? And no, why is somebody talking back to you? And I'm like, it's, you know, we're all saying what we're doing so that we're all aware, you know, I can. And then she was also like, well, how do you know what other people are saying? Because she just hears a bunch of jumbled stuff, you know, yep. She doesn't know what's going on. And I'm like, you know, well, that's part of going through the training for, you know, so long, and you just get used to hearing that. And so now I can just, you know, just pick it out, you know, tune in when I need to and hear my tail number, you know, that kind of stuff when you're listening to by following or something like that. But it was a very good afternoon, very productive. And I don't know, 2.8 hours that day. So I had a blast and everyone else did too. So it was, and it was actually pretty smooth. You know, it was a little bumpy when you got down because I didn't go very high. I stayed right around 1,000, 1,500 feet.
Well, I do that from the ramp.
Yeah. I only went maybe 5 miles from the airport. You know, I mean, their house is literally right there. So, but yeah, it was cool. So I had a blast.
Excellent.
That's about all I've done recently. Trying to get up again. So hopefully soon, next week or two, I'll find some time and snag an airplane. So
get her done.
I know. I got until mid January until my 90 days runs out. So I'm not gonna let that happen. But
no. Maybe a Christmas Day flight.
I'm way too busy on Christmas Day. But yeah, so that's what I got. I hear Mark has done some right seat flying.
Yeah, I did some right seat flying. I haven't had a chance to take the Archer up or the Warrior. I could fly the Warrior up or not too. But, yeah, my buddy Keith has got his SR-20, his Cirrus. He called me up and said, hey, are you working today? And I happened to be at home and, he needed to do some, some currency work for his IFR. So I did the right seat safety pilot, and I learned a ton from the perspective of a wannabe instrument student. And he taught me a bunch of stuff, and this is where we're going to do, and this is, you know, how we do this hold, and this is how we do this approach, and, you know, this is how we file an IFR plan. And I had a pretty good idea about how to file and everything, but you learn more about what each one of those little tiny things means. So we walked through that, and we did about that day about 2 hours out to one of the local training airports north of us here. They get a lot of training traffic for, especially for instrument stuff, ton of approaches. Spent a lot of time talking to NorCal approach, and that was really, it was really interesting. He let me do some of the little bit of radio work while he was simulating. He never put the foggles or anything on, but he went through all the motions and made sure everything was in line. It was cool to do. It was like I said, eye opening. The next trip we did, again, he called me up. He's all, "Hey, I'm kind of feeling in need for speed." And, so my daughter Haley, the future pilot, myself and Keith, we went to this, little tiny, I had no idea this place existed. He goes, "Hey, let's go up to Shelter Cove." I'm like, "Where is this?" And for those in California, it's about, 2/3 the way up the coastline. If you've ever seen the movie The Birds, that was actually filmed in Bodega Bay. It's actually north of that, but it's this little seaside town that's very similar to Bodega Bay. There's about a, I want to say it's probably a 3,500 foot runway right off the coast. It sits on top of, or I guess how you say, how would you describe it? There's a 9-hole golf course that is on both sides of the runway. So you have to be careful. You have to fly over, let people know that you're coming in, then jump in the pattern, and then land. And hopefully they respect you enough that they're not trying to drive as you're landing towards them. But it was gorgeous. Well, I actually took a video of the landing. And I think I posted it up on our Facebook page,
I remember seeing it. It was cool.
Yeah, that was it was a cool little town, and it happened to be. What's funny about these little coastal towns, especially here in California, is that even though there's a runway there, you could only get in there, from what I understand, like maybe 3 months out of the year, because otherwise it's fogged in, or there's a marine layer, or you know, it's just almost impossible to get into. There is no instrument approach. It's literally a piece of asphalt with some stripes and some numbers on it, and that's it. There's no PAPI, no VASI, nothing. But it was gorgeous. We landed, went and got a soda, kind of hung out, watched some other people come in and take off, and saw some whales, saw some dolphins while we were up. It was a really cool day. That flight, as we were getting ready for that flight, I should say, I kind of backtrack a little bit. Keith and I were talking more about my growth, I guess you could say, as a pilot, as a private pilot. And so we laid the chart out while we were still in the hangar. We kind of talked about our flight path and where we were going to go, and we were going to, which VOR we were going to go, and then come up the coastline. And we talked more like pilots, you know. It was really kind of cool. It wasn't like I was a student anymore. And he said, "Well, what do you think? Well, what should we do here?" You know, so it was, we engaged and we planned the route together. And once we all got into the plane, we, started up, made our calls. And he had me taxi, which, for those that have never been in a Cirrus, it has a castoring nose wheel. So it's, you steer with brakes. And that, the last time I had done that was a year ago in that plane. And it freaked me out because I'm so used to actually having, you know, to be able to drive with the rudder pedals. But now I'm a lot more comfortable with it. We've flown several times since then, together. So he let me taxi. So while he was putting in the flight plan into the the Avedon. But I taxied it out. He did his pre-flight run up and went through all the checklists and everything. And he goes, okay, make your radio call. Let's get us in the air. So I got us out and took us off, and he goes, okay, so here's our heading. I'm going to call NorCal. I'll make the radio call. He called them up. They gave us our heading. So I climbed us out on the heading, and we got to our altitude. And he goes, okay, I'm going to let George fly now. And he hit the autopilot, and it kind of took over from there. But it was a lot of fun. I'm a lot more comfortable in that airframe. I just wish I had the money to buy into that, buy a third of that airplane, because it's so much fun to fly. It's very, very easy to fly.
What's that side stick like with your right arm?
It is, you know what, it's almost like you think about making a turn and you start to make a turn. You want to nose up a little bit. It's almost like you're thinking about it. The movement is very, very minor. There's not a lot of stickiness in the stick, is what I was kind of thinking it would be. You'd have a little bit of,
it's pushback
or feedback or whatever.
A little more fluid than what you'd think.
Absolutely. And that's a good term for it. It's a very fluid stick, and it's a lot of fun to fly. It really is. Constantly flying it with the autopilot on, I think, takes some of the fun out of it. But you know what? It's very smooth. He's got the new, I can't remember what it's called. They upgraded to the new autopilot. They're both instrument rated, he and his partner in the plane.
Is it a S-Tech?
Autopilot?
S-Tech 55X?
I'm not sure. I think that might be what it is.
That's what's in the Archer that I fly.
But it'll fly it right down to the numbers on the when you have your the instrument. You have it all set up. So if you're going to fly down a precision approach, it'll take you right down to the numbers.
Nice.
So he says he hasn't done it yet and he wants to try it. But I said, give me a call when you want to do it, because I think that'd be kind of fun to, watch George get us right down to the number. So
I'd so rather fly that with my right arm than my left.
That was one of the things I'm thinking, is that you would, think about an F-16 pilot. You've got the throttle in the left hand and the stick in the right. And that was actually kind of comfortable for me. But they all obviously have to fly with their left hand and the throttle on the right hand. So,
it's much better
with in the left seat or the right seat?
In the left seat.
Yeah.
Because you can use your right hand to do all the precision stuff of messing with the radios and everything else.
Mm-hmm. And I could totally see that. One of the problems that I had when I was taking off is I'm trying to look down the runway and keep us centered and do what I was needed to do. But then the quick glance over to the left MFD to look at my V numbers and looking for my airspeeds and making sure that everything was in the green, that was tough for me to do from the right seat.
Because that cockpit is designed for that left seat. It's angled that way some,
yep,
right?
Absolutely. So from the left seat, everything is right there in your face where it's supposed to be, which is perfect. So, one of these days when I get enough time and probably enough confidence, maybe he'll I have to go through, there's like a 10-hour course for Cirrus that you need to have to truly be certified to fly in a Cirrus, I believe. But one of our friends who's a CFII former stealth fighter pilot, he's a Cirrus certified instructor. So he told me, whenever you're ready, we'll be more than happy to go do that. So, but doing all of this instrument stuff, being the safety pilot, and then this last flight, which was a week ago, 2 weeks ago, really got my juices flowing. And I've since started the ground school for instrument. I need 20 more hours of PIC time before I can actually start the training. But because you need 50 hours of PIC time. And I'm close. So I've got the Sporties instrument course. My car that I commute in actually has a DVD player in it. You can't watch the video while you're driving, but you can hear it. So I've been listening to those DVDs, and Rob Ryder is a great voice to have in your head as you're driving. He's very calming. So I've been listening to those DVDs over and over and over. So I've learned a lot about precision approaches and holds and, you know.
Rob was at our Potapalooza this year.
Was he?
Mm-hmm.
He's a great guy. He's actually announced here at the California Capital Air Show. And I got to meet him 2 years ago. Super, super nice guy.
Yeah, he's got a pretty good gig.
Yeah, he does. Yeah, he does. So basically, that's where I'm at right now. I'm in the early stages of you know, like I said, the ground school, the instrument rating. It's a lot to learn, and I can understand why people say it's the hardest course to take of all of your training that you can get. There's a lot of information to absorb. So that's why I'm taking it at my pace. I'm not gonna rush it by any means, but I want to, you know, immerse myself in the terminology and the, you know, the basics that I need to know, and then maybe this summer, later, you know, summer 2014, I may start actually flying it. So we'll see.
Nice.
How it goes.
Good for you.
Hope, so,
yeah, that would be
hope
nice.
You do. Yeah.
In the meantime, I'm actually going to go get my my high performance in my complex. So I'll have those endorsements, and that way I can either fly the Aero, or, you know, if I can get Cirrus certified, that I could actually rent a Cirrus, or, you know, something like that. I would actually like to do the instrument training in the Cirrus. I think it's perfectly suited for it, but I don't have one rentable so near me. So
six pack is better anyway.
You know, I've heard both ways. The Archer that I have, the Archer and the Warrior that I'm currently allowed to fly, can only fly non-precision approaches. So the GPS that's in there is old school. I mean, to the point that I think it's got a squirrel in the back running it.
It doesn't have an ILS.
It's got an ADF. It's got obviously the dual VOR. So it might have an ILS. It might. But I'm not quite sure because I've never used it for that. So I have to check next time I go up and fly. I actually wanted to go. I'm going to have the last 2 weeks of the year off. So I'm going to try to go up a handful of times and take some friends and family up, you know, towards the end of the year. So we'll see how that goes.
Nice.
If it does have the ILS in it, then I'll report back. The one thing I asked my buddy Keith, I'm like, have you ever done a DME arc approach? And he goes, there's only like one place in Northern California that even uses that. So I don't think that you're going to get questioned on that.
Oh, that's funny. I've a bunch of them.
So yeah, very few. Yeah. He goes, it was actually scratching his head. And he's like, I can't think of one airport in Northern or Central California that uses DME arcs. He goes, you're going to get training on it, but that's about it. He goes, for his check ride, they didn't do one because there wasn't one near.
They're really easy.
Well, I'm sure. That was one of my questions to him is, you know, how do you fly a DME arc? And I said, do you actually try to fly the arc, or do you fly, you know, 10-degree segments, you know, and, you know, for that time and distance? And he goes, yeah, you just do the time and distance. And he goes, it's kind of an ugly thing as itself, but just, you know, watch your distance to the station and make your turns. And like, okay. So as I progress through that, I'll definitely report back and let everybody know how that's going. So, but that's all I've been
good
up
to. Good times. All right. Well, I think we're running out of our time that we'd kind of set aside. I think we busted our hour and 15, John. I'm sorry.
We didn't bust the hour and 15 minutes, and I was actually going to bring up, if you guys wanted to talk about it, the shell fuel, because I think some of the other stuff on our list we could probably tie an entire episode on, so we'll save those for the next episode. But I believe last week, Shell announced that they apparently have a 100-octane replacement.
No lead, 100-octane, yeah.
Unleaded replacement, and supposedly it works in a wide range of fuels, including high compression engines. So I was just
curious what your guys' thoughts were on this news. I know there's also there was the Gammy Fuel, and what was the other one? Swift.
Swift. Uh-huh.
I believe were the two that were talking about. And then out of left field, Shell's like, "Oh, we got one."
Yeah, that just seemed to kind of pop up out of nowhere, didn't it? It's like they were keeping real silent about it.
I'm interested in it. I'm not sure it's really going to be what everybody was hoping when, I mean, because obviously they came out with this whole announcement and they're like, oh, but we got a replacement. And everybody's like, oh my God, there's a replacement. And it's like, you look at it and you're like, well, they are promising an awful lot, but.
Personally, I don't care about any of these about, if they can do it, great. If they can make it in such a quantity to where they can do it at a better price than 100 low lead, then I am so for it. It's not even funny.
None of these are going to be cheaper than 100 low lead.
Yeah.
Then stop wasting my time. I understand 100 low lead is bad for the environment, but in the grand scheme of things, the amount of it that's burned in comparison to automobiles or even jet aircraft is such a small percentage. Let's just quit talking about it. Unless you can do something to actually make it more affordable, just quit fooling around. It annoys me more than anything. I mean, yay.
Honestly, in the grand scheme of things, by the time they finally get this figured out, our grandkids are going to be flying. So.
Very well might be, you know. Yeah, see, there's one manufacturer of 100 low lead. So, you know, the market is what they say it's going to be.
Yeah, and that's kind of my issue with the leaded fuel isn't necessarily obviously bad for the environment is one thing. And, you know, it's bad for the environment. But like you said, I mean, it's really not in a huge amount of quantities. And I mean, even the jet fuel that's used, they've done studies and it doesn't really amount to a whole lot. A lot of it is generating power and automobiles that do a lot of the pollution. But the thing that worries me the most is the fact that you do have this monopoly on lead production for fuel. Mm-hmm. And you've got one company that decides whether or not, you know, they do the lead on the fuel. So that's what scares me more than anything is just there's one single fail point. And the thing with the Shell fuels that bothers me is it's not clear yet what Shell's going to do as far as selling this fuel and making it, because they can go one of two ways. Since they are a fuel company, I mean, they can do the refineries and own the refineries themselves and sell this fuel.
Exactly.
So if this is the fuel that the FAA is going to decide, hey, this is the replacement for 100 low lead, well, if Shell decides to make it all, well, then we still have that single point of failure or single point of rape your wallet.
I don't think it's the FAA who decides that. I think it's the market.
The FAA doesn't get to decide who makes fuel.
It'd be like 10 companies come out there and decide they have a replacement and they guarantee it works in the engine that you're running in your plane. Great. Is it available at an airport that I'm at? And, you know, can you make it at a price that I'm willing to pay for it? If not, then you're just not going to be around. Market says so.
Yeah, well, I guess the thing, what I'm really meant to say is that they're doing a whole study thing where they're trying to come up with us. They have like a committee that's, I guess, dealing with these new fuels or whatnot. The thing is that in order to get it, all of the FBOs and everything are going to have to decide that's what we want to carry or whatnot, because it also depends on what the fuels can mix. Because if they can't, then you run into issues. Well, where can you go to get the fuel? Where can you go to not get the fuel? But they carry this, but we carry this, but we can't mix the two. And so it's kind of iffy on what's going to happen there. But if Shell were to emerge as the product that everybody kind of, I guess, collectively agrees on,
mm-hmm.
And they're the refinery, that becomes an issue. Or they might end up licensing, you know, the fuel, or in that case, anybody could kind of refine it. And then I think that would be a little better, I guess, for me, in the fact that you don't have Shell. You know, you don't have the same thing where it's like one lead company or one fuel company is doing all of the fuel.
Well, at least they're large enough. You know, everybody knows Shell Oil. At least they're large enough that they can pull this off without having to go to another company. They can do it all in-house, unlike, you know, Swift. Yeah, they can come up with the chemistry behind it, but they have no way of manufacturing it. And Gammy the same way. At least Shell has that going for them.
Yeah, and that is the upside to the whole thing, and that is also one of the things I thought about too when I was looking at this, and I was like, well, you know, if anybody's going to do it, a fuel company like that coming with their own product would be able to.
Brad probably can remember, and probably Mark too, of being able to actually go to a gas station and get regular gasoline. When I first started driving, when I was 16, that would have been 1986 or 7. And okay. I can still remember it then.
Yeah, I don't remember that.
That's because you're the baby.
The leaded gas phase-out happened in the 70s.
Yeah, it was the late 70s.
Really? Well, yeah. I just remembered my parents doing it then. I know I did never actually had to purchase it because my car was unleaded the first one I got. But
I was born in 88 either way. So
either way.
I wasn't around.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I can remember a couple of our old cars, like a 1970s Thunderbird that we had. That I think it probably took leaded gasoline. Anywho,
but either way, I don't think any of these fuels—they're not going to be any cheaper. And
that's really what's going to change the face and of aviation and the amount of pilots. That one thing alone—if you can drive that down to somewhere where it makes sense. I mean, $5 and $6 a gallon for gas, and even more in you know, the East Coast where you're at, probably in California.
No, it's $5, $5.50.
Is it?
There's not a whole lot you can do about it though, because you manufacture it in such low quantities. It's not like MoGas, and you have to have completely separate distribution.
There's so much even profit in regular fuel though. There's so much profit. Those refinery or those oil companies are making tens of billions, hundreds of billions of dollars in profits every year. They're even controlling the market to some extent, even though there's more of them.
Yeah, but the other thing too, at the same time, is that we as a pilot community have been pushing for paying for aviation through the fuel tax.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a much higher tax on fuel than MoGas or anything else too, and we've been pushing for that in the instead of user fees, because the one thing we never want to see is user fees. So instead, we pay for it in our fuel.
This is where I see the diesel engines like just starting to come out in droves, probably in the next decade or so. So we'll see more and more planes getting retrofitted with diesel engines.
They can get them light enough. That's the problem with them is weight.
Yeah.
Right. They're very, very heavy to manage all that compression.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's going to be interesting the next couple of years to see how this plays out and to see especially how Swift and Gammy kind of respond to the Shell announcement. And obviously, I mean,
I'm sure they knew about them.
I'm not so sure.
You think it just, you know, took them for a loop as well? Like, what? Where did they come from?
Yeah, because what – I mean –
because they've probably talked to them about some sort of manufacturing of it for them and whatnot, and probably they're like, well, we might be doing this ourselves.
Well, I don't know how much Gammy and I don't know much about it, but I don't know how much they've you know, talked to other companies about distribution stuff as much as just trying to find the right chemistry. You know, I don't really know. I don't know much. I haven't followed it that closely, but it'll be interesting for sure, and obviously, it's going to be a very slow process, but, you know, maybe by 2020, we'll have a better idea about what's going to be happening. And
I hope so. It'll
be interesting. So,
we still have
anything else? Mm-hmm. What was that?
I said we still have a few more minutes.
Not really.
Not too much. Well, very interesting, an interesting topic is, you all know that I now own an Apple product.
Not by choice. Come on, you want it.
That's right. Yeah, I'm sporting an iPad 4th generation, 16 gig Wi-Fi. I did win it in a poker tournament, which was fantastic because there was just no way I was ever spending $450 on one of these things. So I've got it. I've flown
it. No way, huh?
No way. No chance.
Did you load 4Flight?
So I put 4Flight on it. And I thought it was supposed to be the be-all to end-all to, you know, navigation on the iPad, and I found it to be good, not amazing. Maybe that's just going to take some more time using it, but
learn how to use it, because it's amazing, especially when you know that you've got a GPS that works.
Yeah. So going back to that, so since it is the Wi-Fi version, you have to have an external GPS, because you only get the GPS in your iPad if you have the 4G version or 3G version, as it were, whatever. Mm-hmm. So I have a Bluetooth GPS that I've had for years. In fact, I used to use it back when I had a Windows mobile phone back in the day. So, you know, the iPad does not see it. The iPad doesn't see anything. I turned on my my cell phone and my Google Nexus 7 tablet, and they see the Bluetooth GPS receiver and the iPad, but the iPad don't see anybody. So I thought maybe the Bluetooth was just broke on it. I turned on my I have a little Bluetooth headset, and it works fine, or the iPad sees it just fine. So come to find out, you know, maybe it's just too old of Bluetooth technology that's within that old GPS. So someone goes, they didn't pay the Apple tax. Well, might be true, too. You know, Apple don't play nice with everybody, apparently. And so I ended up going out and buying one of the dual Sky Sport GPS 160 model. It has the WAZ integration to it. It also does GLONASS satellites, which are the Russian satellites. So it was a nice little add-on. And even with that, I had the GPS lose connection in flight a couple times on that flight where I went up north to go see the hole in the ground.
Is that the one with the red button in the middle?
That's the one that looks like a little red hockey puck.
Yeah, so a friend of mine had it, and there was a lot of issues with that one. I don't know what the deal is with that, but I've heard a lot of people having issues with keeping a connection at all. We couldn't even get the connection at all with that one.
Well, here's the weird deal about it. And last night I flew with it and flew flawlessly. I never lost it once, right? But what I found was that it, according to the iPad, it said it was connected Bluetooth-wise, right? But I go to I go to 4Flight, and it says, no, you're not connected to a GPS. I'm like, well, you know, the iPad says I am. So I'd have to recycle everything. And then
being connected by Bluetooth and then having it actually share location data is a totally separate thing. Apparently. And apparently with those, you have to have a separate app that starts it up or something sometimes too. It's very weird. It's kind of wonky. And I really Bluetooth is kind of really finicky to begin with anyway. When it works, it's great, but for the most part, I just find that Bluetooth is generally just kind of problematic.
Yeah.
Everywhere. I mean, even when I had my Android Nexus, I found that the Bluetooth was just it kind of hit or miss on whether things would work. So,
mm-hmm.
But when it does work, it's great. And
I think one of the workarounds that they've had, and sorry, John, I don't mean to cut you off, but
yeah, no,
I think it's Bad Elf. It might be one of the ones that they have that it actually plugs into the port, so yep. It's a direct connect.
You're right.
And I've got some friends that have actually gotten rid of their dual. I have a 150 that I have troubles connecting to sometimes, and I've thought about they had a trade in period at one point in time that I think I missed it by like a week, but I may try to sell my 150 and get, I don't know, something else dual, or maybe one of the Bad Elf ones. But I don't mean to knock products, especially on our podcast, but the ones that are plugging directly into the iPad, and they're pretty low profile, so it's not like you're going to break them off, work really well. So I'm thinking seriously about converting, because I use my iPad, you know, not really for navigation or anything, but kind of just to back up where I'm at. You know, I don't use it as a primary navigation tool but it helps me get along. But that's one of the things that I think a lot of people, like I said, a few of my friends have actually converted over to the Bad Elf ones, and they've had nothing but success.
Yeah. See, my iPad does have GPS in it. And, although it's not perfect, it works close enough that it gives me a general idea on the map, but I'm really using the map as a map, you know. I'm using the references in the map and making sure it fits with what my site picture is. The fact that it puts a little plane on there is just an added bonus to give me a, hey, it thinks I'm around here, cool.
Right.
Obviously, in your case, when you get a Wi-Fi iPad or something like that, you know, that's a different story. You know, you have to get an external GPS to get any kind of location while you're up there.
Yeah.
But
the dual
at least.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, at least with the iPad, I haven't flown with the iPad mini with Retina display yet, but the iPad I had before, the iPad mini, the first generation, and even the iPad 1, both of those, I'm sorry, not the iPad 1, the iPad 3, I think, they both, the internal GPSs worked fairly well in the plane, so.
Well, here's my, the dual, I have an app too for it. The XGPS 160 is the model that I have, and they have an app, and it tells you whether or not you're connected, how many satellites, all that yada yada stuff. It also will record your trip for you and show it back to you. It'll give you a file that you can open up in Google Earth, et cetera, et cetera. So, and I updated the firmware last night before I flew too, so maybe that helped. Anyway, so last night's flight was flawless, and I ended up using Flight Plan's app, the FLTPLAN Flight Plan. You've probably heard of it before. I used their app last night for navigation, and it worked really well. So I'm still out there trying different things. The next time I go up, I'm going to go try what's the other one? Oh, the FlyQ. Have any of you tried that one, the FlyQ? No.
I looked at it. It didn't really do much for me. From what I've used, I like ForeFlight the best. Though I will say, I find the interface a little lacking sometimes, especially in the iPhone. I kind of don't like the iPhone version that much, but the iPad version, you know, it works very well. But I think it could use some, visual updates to help move around a little quicker. And my biggest complaint was just if I'm trying to look up frequencies or something quickly for something on there, you know, I want to just tap it and then click on it. The problem I have is that when you're in an airplane and it's moving around, the touch targets are too small. And that was kind of my biggest complaint.
I agree with that, because I got kind of fat fingers.
Yeah, it works. And obviously, you know, they kind of tout it a lot more for pre-flight stuff and, you know, doing that kind of thing.
It's great for filing your plans and everything else. So it's
for looking up weather for flight planning. Yeah. And all that stuff. It's great. I love having them out there. It's just that I wish the targets were a little bigger when I'm actually flying. And there's a couple other issues, but it would almost be nice to have like a separate, you know, kind of mode for just flying that it goes into, kind of like a car mode on phones. But anyways, think you guys want to go ahead and wrap this up.
Yeah, we better wrap it up. We got lots of topics still to talk about, but we'll push them on to next time, I guess.
So 33. Yeah, we'll do that soon.
33. Shout-outs?
Shout-outs. Chris, I heard you had a shout-out.
I got a shout-out. I want to have a quick shout-out for my buddy David Paul. He's CFII. He's who I did my recent flight review with. David recently, quickly, might I add, got his ATP.
Wow.
Yeah.
Very cool.
And after he had that, boom, he got a job with ExecJet. So
that's cool. Nice.
He's, I think, down in Florida right now. Been doing his training and simulator and all that stuff. So he's having a good time and learned all the systems and CRM training, yada, 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 having a great time. And so he's going to be a jet jockey soon.
Sweet.
Nice.
Yeah. So that's pretty cool. David's no spring chicken either. David's in his early 60s, I guess.
Wow.
So he's going to be the most senior in age, at least, right seater and first officer for one of those jets that they got.
That's surprising.
Yeah.
Good for him, though.
Yeah. Exciting.
Yeah.
So, Mark, Brian, you guys got any shout-outs real quick?
Brad, I've got a shout-out for David Phil of the Airplane Owners podcast. He's getting that thing off the ground and he's doing a really good job.
I've been listening to that, too. Yeah. Good stuff. I think he's got four episodes out, or is there more?
Is that about right? I think he's just on episode two, but he had a zero, so I think it counts as three total.
Oh, okay. I wonder if I'm thinking of a different one. I'll have to check now.
Cool. Mark, you got anything?
I do. I have one. I just want to welcome home a good friend of mine, Dennis Pearson. He's co-owner of the flight school, but he was recalled into the Air Force almost 3 years ago. He's actually been at Randolph Air Force Base flying, and we would think that this would be a cool job, but he flies T-38s as an instructor. But he was flying four sorties a day, 6 days a week for the past 2.5, almost 3 years now. So he's ready to retire. So he'll be home in eight. Yeah. He'll be home in 8 days. And he's looking forward to being permanently retired, from the Air Force. So welcome home, Dennis. I actually look forward to seeing you in person.
And I've got one real quick. For those of you who listen to Airspeed, Steve Tupper's long, long-running podcast, he actually just released the third of three installments on air shows, this air show series. And it started out with him helping out in an air show, through him being an announcer, and then finally flying in an air show. He plays some motor gliders. And it's been really cool listening to him kind of do a chronicle on his journey through watching air shows to being a part of them. So, yeah, go check that out if you haven't already at Airspeed, airspeedonline.com, I believe.
Yep, that's it. It's a great mini-series, and you don't want to talk about, you know, an aviation junkie slash fanboy, as he calls himself. Talk about living the dream, going from...
Yeah.
I've heard him go from getting his private all the way up through flying with the Thunderbirds and getting a type rating. And yeah, Steve's definitely living the dream.
That is. So that's going to be all the shout outs. So before we go ahead and head out of here, let's let everybody know where you can find us, how you can get in touch with us, and let us know what you think of the podcast and if you have any questions or anything else. So Chris, let's go ahead and start with you.
Sure, you can reach me on Twitter at CHOLUBAZ. That's CHOLUBAZ. That's also my YouTube channel name if you want to go check out some of my flying videos. You can email me at chris@inthepatternpodcast.com.
Cool, and Mark, where can we find you?
You could find me at Mark at In the Pattern Podcast. You can find me on Twitter as Student Pilot Mark. Student Pilot Mark is also my my YouTube name, so I've got a few videos up there too. I need to update that. Then you can always get a hold of me through the Facebook page too.
And Brad, when you're not hiding from Google, where are you?
Hiding from the NSA. You can reach me on Twitter at Brad Kane, and also via email at brad@inthepatternpodcast.com. And Kane is Kilo Oscar Echo Hotel November.
It's not Cohen, you sure?
Pretty sure.
It's just Cohen to me. Me only.
And you can reach me, John, at InThePatternPodcast.com. I am on Twitter and app.net and pretty much everywhere else, at Pilot Conway. For the entire podcast, if you want to get a hold of us, you can reach all of us at once. Just send an email to podcast@InThePatternPodcast.com. Our website is InThePatternPodcast.com. And you can go ahead and like us on Facebook as well at InThePatternPodcast. If you'd like updates on new episodes, you can go to our homepage, join the mailing list to stay updated with each episode release. We won't use your information for anything other than just new episode updates. So if you'd like that, it's on the right side of our homepage. And finally, you can call us or leave a voicemail if you'd like at 707-PCAST-01, and that's 707-PAPA-CHARLIE-ALPHA-ZERO-TANGO-01. Please send us your suggestions and comments. We'd love to get feedback from our listeners. And also, if you really like the show, go ahead and give us some feedback on iTunes and let others be able to search and find the show as well. So that would be a big help.
So with that, we're going to go ahead and wrap up this episode 32 of the In the Pattern podcast. We'd like to thank our affiliates for the episode, Stuck Mike Avcast. And we'd also like to thank you for listening and for making all of this worthwhile. So remember, make left traffic. You are cleared for the option.
Find this and other great shows at the Aviation Media Network.
The Voices in Your Head .com.
Any phones, dogs, anything else? Shut them up.
Yes, shut them off. Yeah, we have. Come here, Kevin. Let me turn your off switch.
Yeah, hit the mute button.